millions of bugs that lived in the trees surrounding us. I don't know why that made it feel more bearable. Our red escort was the same boy we'd had the night before, hair shaved, eyes dark and almond-shaped. Beside me, Sam cringed, her hands balled up tight at her sides, and limped along. They took the life out of them, I thought, stepping through the low white fence and taking the small plastic shovel that was handed to me. I knew so little about how they had been, what had Clancy called it, reprogrammed, reconditioned. Mason had been shattered by what they'd done to his mind. Maybe they'd made a mistake with him, or he hadn't been strong enough to take what they'd dealt him. How many Reds were involved in Project Jamboree? Was it possible that... No. Stop it, I ordered myself. Think about anything else but that. A PSF was passing out heavy work coats, which they allowed us to have while we were out here. He looked down at the number across my chest and skipped me completely. The 10-year-old me would have accepted the punishment, mind fixed on the cruel smile the soldier offered in exchange instead. But I didn't have to accept anything now. His mind was like glass, and all I had to do was pass through it like a ray of light. I shuffled back, taking the coat from him. I followed my line down to the mounds of earth they'd turned up yesterday and knelt down. The dirt gave way under the softest touch, packing beneath my nails as I used the shovel to ease the buried potatoes up from the ground. I brushed the dark dirt away. The shade of burnt skin. I pressed the back of my hand against my mouth, instinctively looking up at the three red vests standing near the entrance. They stoically watched as each cabin of kids filed in and accepted their assignments. Are they the same Reds? My fingers flexed, tightening around the shovel. I glanced sideways to my right. Sam was only miming work, smoothing dirt away. Still, after all this time, they forced us into alphabetical order. How long have they been here? I asked in a low voice. The Reds. At first, I wasn't sure she'd heard me. I pulled the next potato up and dropped it into the plastic tub between us. 3 months, maybe? Was the reply, just as quiet. I'm not sure. I sagged slightly, blowing out a soft sigh. They weren't sawtooth Reds, but that meant more camps, more reconditioning facilities. Don't you recognize some of them? Sam whispered, leaning over as if to help me. A few of them used to be here. I couldn't risk another glance back to confirm this. I'm not sure I would have been able to anyway. The Reds at Thurmond had always lived in my memory with shadowed faces. All of the dangerous ones did. But I knew for certain that I didn't recognize the Red that Sam kept searching for. Every time she found him, she shuddered and oriented herself away from his gaze. But, like clockwork, she'd look up at him again. Do you know him? I whispered. She hesitated so long, I didn't think she would answer. But finally, she nodded. From before? Before? Sam swallowed hard, then nodded again. Sympathy swept through me, leaving me at a loss for what to say. I couldn't begin to imagine what this felt like. A PSF passed behind us, whistling without a tune, making his way up the rows between each patch of vegetation. The garden was enormous, at least half a mile long, and required the most supervision. The handheld white noise machine clattered against his supply belt, swaying in time to his slow steps. I risked another glance up, realizing why my skin had crawled the moment he came into sight. This was one of the PSFs who oversaw work in the factory, the one who liked to press himself up against the girls, hassle them to get them flustered, and then punish them for reacting in any small way. It hadn't made sense then what he was doing to me, to Sam, to the other girls, and we'd just stood there and taken it silently. Now, though? Now I had a pretty good sense of what he'd really been doing, and it lit my fury. He strolled by us, and Sam stiffened. I wondered if she could smell him too, a salty, sharp tang of vinegar mixed with cigarette smoke and aftershave. I didn't relax until he was a good 10 girls away from us. "Ruby," Sam whispered, earning admonishing glances from the girls working the row across from us. "Something happened after you left. I realized something was wrong. With me. My head." My sight narrowed to the hole in front of me. "Nothing's wrong with you."
"I missed you," she said. "So much. But I barely know you. And then I get these senses, these images. They come like dreams."
I shook my head, fighting to keep my pulse steady.
"Don't you dare. You can't. If anyone catches on, if she slips up..."
"You're different," Sam finished.
"Aren't you? You've always been..."
Sam was ripped away, hauled back and away from my side. I whirled around. The PSF from before was back, his hand knotted in Sam's long ponytail.
"You know the rules," he snarled. "We work silently or we don't work at all."
For the first time, I saw what this past year had done to my friend. The old Sam, the one who had stood up for me countless times, would have spat back an insult or tried to twist out of his grasp, struggled in some small way. Now, her dirt-stained hands went up to protect herself without a beat of hesitation, a practiced movement. Her whole body sagged as he shoved her forward, sending her sprawling into the mud. Fury whipped through me, and then it wasn't enough for me that I would kill this man, eventually. I wanted to humiliate him. I pushed a single image into his mind, an urge that was easy enough to suggest. The front of his black camo pants darkened, the stain spreading down his leg. I jumped back in overblown disgust, catching the attention of another PSF just across the row of vegetation. He came back to himself with a shudder, and with slow, dawning horror, looked down.
"Shit. Shit."
"Tilden," the PSF who'd been watching called out. "Status?"
"Shit."
The man's face burned pink as he covered himself, seemingly torn between staying as he was or excusing himself to take care of the situation. Kids were sneaking glances at him, at each other. He seemed to realize it, too, and rose on unsteady feet. I had just enough of a grip left on his mind to slide my right leg out to the side and listen as his own leg mirrored the response and sent him crashing to his knees just before he reached the gate. The PSF, Tilden, he'd think he had tripped over someone. The image was the last one I planted before gently peeling back from his mind, refusing to watch as he walked briskly in the direction of the control tower. "Too much," I chastised myself. Next time I'd have to go for something subtler. But this one I wouldn't regret, no matter what. I rose unsteadily onto my feet to help Sam back onto hers, guiding her back over to our places. She was shaking, staring at me as if she knew what had really happened.
"Fix it," she whispered. "Whatever you did to me. Please. I need to know."
I couldn't bring myself to look at her, knowing what sort of expression I'd see there. It had been like this with Liam, hadn't it? All of the feelings, none of the memories. That's what I'd left her with. No wonder she had seemed so confused and hostile after I'd wiped her memory. It must have been overwhelming. If she'd felt half as close to me as I did to her, the strange sense that something was wrong must have torn at her each day. I met her pleading eyes with a plea of my own, and just like always, she understood. A spark of the old Sam surfaced. Her eyebrows drew together, and she pursed her lips. This was the silent language we'd developed over the years. The PSF, who'd been gazing in our direction, hand shading his eyes to make out Tilden's distant form growing smaller and smaller,
stepped over the mounds into our row. I tensed, waiting to feel his shadow cast over me.
Try it, I thought. Try it with any of these kids and see where it gets you.
Instead, he walked away, continuing the watch that Tilden had been forced to abandon. I held my breath and slid my hand over, under the loose dirt, to grip Sam's. We worked through the morning into the afternoon, with only a small break to eat the apples and sandwiches they distributed for lunch. I devoured mine with dirt-stained hands, watching the changing colors of the sky. And that night, as I lay in the bunk beneath her, I slipped into Sam's mind as soft as a breeze. I thought of that morning I'd stepped up beside her in the infirmary, the way her coat's tag had flipped up against her neck, the exact moment I'd taken her memories of me by mistake, the heaviness in my chest still unbearable as the moment played through. The images were in her mind now, too, perfectly matched with mine. I was swept along with them, falling through the white, fluttering images around me. Her memories were almost too bright to watch, the wisps too thin to grasp. But I knew what I was looking for when I saw it. The black knot buried deep beneath the others. I reached out, touching it, increasing the pressure until it unraveled. If each memory that drifted up were a star, I was standing at the center of a galaxy, beneath vast constellations of lost smiles and quiet laughter, whole endless days of gray and brown and black that we'd spent with only each other to hold on to. I'd assumed she'd been asleep the whole time. Her mind had been so calm and still under my touch. But a pale arm came down over the side of the bunk, stretching down toward me. The familiar gesture stole the air from my chest, and I had to press my lips together to keep back the tears that came dangerously close to the surface. I reached up, meeting her halfway, locking my fingers around hers. A secret. A promise. 25. My plan came to me in pieces over the next 2 days. I assembled it hastily while I worked in the garden, ignoring the blisters on the palm of my hand, and in those minutes before I passed out in exhausted sleep each night. Knowing that it would be over soon, in a matter of hours, made me feel reckless in a way I hadn't expected. Somehow it was too much time, and yet still not enough. I couldn't shake the fear that the others had changed their timing from the original plan that Cole, Nico, and I had outlined. I'd told them March 1st, but what if it was impossible to get here in time? What if they're not coming at all? I shoved the thought away before it could plant itself too deeply in my heart. At 6 o'clock that evening, I lay in my bunk, hands folded on my stomach. Sam's mattress shifted as she rolled onto her side, distorting the shapes I had made in the plastic. I reached up, taking a small piece of the curling plastic cover between my broken fingernails. Tugging gently, I pulled the strip off, carefully working it around, around, until it formed an even circle.
So the girl, after the robbers decided to take her away, she managed to steal one of their daggers and cut the rope off her hands.
Rachel was leading the story today, filling in the hour before we were called to dinner. Tonight, she wove the tale of yet another nameless girl in yet another perilous situation. I closed my eyes, a faint smile on my lips. The stories hadn't gotten any better or any more original. They all followed the same plot. Girl is wronged, girl struggles, girl escapes. The ultimate fantasy at Thurmond. Physical exhaustion kept me still. As much as I had trained at the ranch, these hours of endless work with no break, unlimited food and water, were designed to drain us of the energy we'd need to muster to escape or push back. My body was a mess of quivering muscles, but I felt oddly calm, even though I knew what would happen if I made one misstep, or they figured out what I was before I could complete what I'd come here to do. I have to walk out of here.
Ruby? Ellie called from her bunk at the center of the room. It's your turn.
I shifted onto my elbows, scooting back to swing my legs off the cramped bunk. I worked out the kinks in my lower back as I thought about how I was going to finish this story.
The girl.
When I was younger, I would have passed it on to Sam after adding only a few words, but I could use this. I wasn't sure they would understand, but I hoped some part of them would recognize the warning when the time came. The girl cut herself loose from the rope and knocked the bandit off the horse in front of her. She took the reins and turned the horse around in the road, heading back in the direction they had come from, back toward the castle. There was a murmur at that. Vanessa had spent the better part of 15 minutes describing the battle raging outside of its walls. It had provided the distraction the bandits needed to take the girl in the first place. She used the darkness, I explained. She left her horse in the nearby forest and crept toward a passage she knew was hidden in the far stone wall. The fighting had stopped once the knights in black had taken the castle. They locked the white knights out, and they were unable to help the families trapped inside. But no one noticed a small, plain girl coming through the back door. She looked like a helpless servant girl bringing a basket of food into the kitchen. For days, she stayed in the castle, watching, waiting for the right moment. And then it came. She slipped back outside and made her way through the shadows of night, unlocking the gate for the white knights to come pouring back in.
Why would she come back? Why didn't she just escape?
Hide, Sam asked, her voice small. I blew out a soft breath, glad that, if nothing else, she understood.
Because, I said finally,
in the end, she couldn't leave her family behind. The girls shifted silently in their bunks, looking at each other as if wondering the same thing. No one asked the question. I don't know how many of them actually dared to hope. But 3 short minutes later, the electronic lock on the cabin's door popped open. The door swung in and a PSF stepped inside.
Line up, she barked.
We hastily assembled in alphabetical order, staring straight ahead as she counted us off. She motioned for the girls at the front of the line to start moving. I couldn't help myself. A step before we reached the door, I glanced back behind me. No matter what happened, it would be the last time I ever saw Cabin 27. But when we walked through the door of the mess hall that evening, I already had to revisit a key component of my plan, because, set up against the wall opposite of us, to the left of the window where we lined up to receive our food, was a large white screen. Orion stood in front of it, his arms crossed over his chest, the blue light from a digital projector washing over him. Sam threw a nervous look my way as our PSF escort pushed her toward our table. The last time we'd seen them use this screen had been our first week here. The camp controllers had set up the projector to scroll through the list of camp rules. No talking during work duties. No talking after lights out. Do not speak to a Psi Special Forces officer unless spoken to first. On and on and on. Rather than have us line up to get food, the PSF signaled for us to sit down and remain seated. The energy in the room was unsettling. I couldn't get a read on any of the camp controllers or PSFs.
There have been some recent developments, Orion said, his natural voice loud enough to carry through the building. Regarding your situation, pay attention. You will only be shown this once.
The move, I thought. They were finally going to tell them about closing the camp. Orion stepped back as the lights were dimmed slightly. A computer was hooked up to the projector, giving us a glimpse of a desktop before the video window expanded and the PSF hit play. The video wasn't about the move. Next to me, Sam actually recoiled, her hand reaching for mine. I blinked in horrified disbelief. It was a sight I hadn't seen in 8 years. President Gray, standing at a podium in front of the crest of the White House.
He smiled so generously that dimples appeared on his cheeks. He waved, beckoned, to someone out of the camera's frame, and, this time, the room full of reporters and cameras in front of him burst into sound as a pale-haired woman stepped up beside him, dressed in an immaculate suit. Dr. Lillian Gray.
"I've never been one to bury the lead, have I?"
President Gray laughed. The First Lady disappeared into the fevered flashing of the cameras. The furious clicking of camera shutters would have put any machine gun to shame.
"It's good to be home in Washington again, to be back in this room with all of you and with my beautiful wife. She's alive and well, contrary to wild speculation."
Nervous laughter in response.
"Her appearance here means that, at long last, I can tell you that our prayers have been answered, and we now have a safe treatment that will rid American children of the psionic disorder forever," he said.
More rumblings from the press, more camera flashes. The kids around me had been trained too well to react outwardly beyond startled gasps of their own, or quick, covert glances at each other. The majority of them just sat there in disbelief.
"For years, Lillian has stayed out of the public eye so as to conduct research on this exact subject. It has remained confidential only to avoid interference from the former terrorist group, the Children's League, and other domestic enemies. While we are continuing to seek out the cause of this tragic affliction, please rest assured that all children will be able to undergo this life-saving operation. Detailed information about the procedure is being distributed to you now."
A few reporters tried to leap in with questions, shouting Lillian's name, trying, I guess, to coax her to the microphone. Instead, she found a patch of carpet to stare at. Whoever had dolled her up had also managed to vacuum the life out of her.
"As you'll see from the footage and reports we've included, our own son, Clancy, was the first to receive this procedure."
A wave of dizziness passed over me as another form was walked out onto the stage beside them by a man in a dark suit. His head had been shaved and covered with a baseball hat decorated with the presidential seal. He kept his face turned down and out of sight, denying the cameras in front of him a shot, until the president leaned away from the microphone and said something to him. His shoulders hunched, Clancy finally lifted his head. He reminded me of a horse on the ground, leg broken under it, never able to stand again, let alone run. With all of the terrible things he'd done, and all of the terrible things I had imagined doing to him, never had this come to mind. I was shocked by the swell of emotions that rose in me, all of them too close, too wild for me to distinguish one from another. I felt sick. He trembled, looking smaller by the moment as his parents kept their smiles plastered on their faces, giving the reporters what they wanted, a family portrait. How perfectly, I thought, have these people drawn Clancy into his own worst nightmare.
"You'll remember that he came out of the camp rehabilitation program several years ago. Unfortunately, like with any disease, there are relapses. And this is one of the reasons why we have not felt comfortable releasing the children from these camps. We needed a more permanent solution, and we believe we have found it. There will be more information to come in regards to a timeline of when the procedure will start being performed and a likely end date for the camp rehabilitation program. I ask you, knowing already how much you've sacrificed and suffered these long years, for more patience, for understanding, for your belief in the future we're about to enter, one that will see the reemergence of our prosperity and way of life. Thank you, and God bless the United States of America."
Before the first avalanche of questions could sweep up and knock him off his feet, President Gray hooked his arm around Lillian's shoulders, gave a friendly wave to the cameras, and guided her off the stage and out of the room before she could get a single word in. The video ended, frozen on that last image. I felt trapped in that moment, too. No, I thought. Remember why you came here. Now. Do it now. Our PSF escort signaled for us to stand and begin reforming our line to receive our meals, her face creased with impatience. The surprise video had put me off my original plan, but it was easy enough to pick up the pieces and reassemble them in working order. We were near the kitchen, shuffling forward, when I felt the eyes of the PSF on me. I shoved Sam, knocking her to the ground, and if that wasn't enough to dry up every small sound around us, me shouting, "Shut up! Just shut up!" to her did. My voice whipped through the silence, landing like a blow across her confused face. "Play along," I begged, flashing her a look. "Please." A small nod. She understood. I lifted my arm, as if to strike her, ignoring the way Vanessa tried to catch my wrist to prevent it. The hardest thing was not reacting to our PSF as she came toward me, crossing the distance between us in furious strides. This was more than enough to get me punished. More than enough to get me ejected from dinner. The girls around us kept their heads down, but their fear and confusion polluted the air around me as the woman caught me by the collar and hauled me away. Orion and the other camp controllers disassembling the projector and screen didn't even look up at the scuffle. I didn't have to suggest anything to the PSF to get her to drag me into the kitchen. The blue kids scrubbing the pots and pans under blistering water jumped. Several that were sorting the ingredients for the next day's meals turned, momentarily distracted from their work. I searched the ceiling for the black cameras, counting them off as I went. 2, 3. One above the serving window, one near the large pantry, another over the long stainless steel work table, where several of the kids were peeling the potatoes we'd only just pulled from the garden. The back of the mess hall faced the forest, providing maybe 10 feet of walking space between the building and the fence. The cameras never recorded what happened there, but only pointed out into the woods. It was one of the blind spots we'd learned to be afraid of very quickly. She pushed the back door open with her shoulder, and I had a second to react. I yanked the PSF around, twisting her arm behind her to the point of snapping the bone. She let out a choked noise of surprise that cut off sharply as I entered her mind. She unfastened her uniform, ripping off her boots, the black camo shirt and pants, the belt, the dark cap, and let them fall to the ground. I kicked off my tennis shoes, trying to match the frenzied pace I'd set in her mind. She took my uniform as I passed it to her, tugging it on with a look of blank obedience. Too calm. I floated the image of her as a young child, standing at the heart of the camp, soldiers moving around her, closing in. I only eased up when she started to cry. The flash drive fell out of my shoe into the frostbitten grass, and I quickly palmed it, squeezing it tight to reassure myself it was really there. The swap had taken no more than 2 minutes. 2 minutes too long, maybe. I couldn't tell. The PSFs were allowed to walk us into dark, unmonitored corners, rough us up a little bit before actually carrying out the punishment. If those missing moments had played that way to the camp controllers watching in the control tower, I'd be fine. I walked the PSF toward the garden, my breath fogging the air white with each sharp exhale. I kept my eyes on the thin chains hooked around one of the fence posts. I wanted to say I was a good enough person not to feel some satisfaction as I sat the PSF down in the cold mud and locked her into place facing the fence, her back to the cameras on the nearby cabins and the soldiers patrolling the platform on the tower. I wasn't. After watching so many kids left out for hours on end, simply for talking back or looking at them sideways on a bad day. I wanted at least one of them to know what it felt like. I wanted one of them to see what they had done to Sam each time they brought her out here. It wasn't until I was walking back, passing the red vests posted along the path to the control tower and mess hall, that the first touch of nerves found me. Somehow, as I came closer to it, the brick tower had grown to be twice its original size. Its crooked walls seemed to lean even more sharply up close. "This is an op," I reminded myself. "This is no different than any other op. I would finish it and go home." The PSF stationed next to the control tower's door peered at me through the darkness. Searchlights from the watch platform above crisscrossed in front of me, sweeping around the camp into the dark pockets where other lights couldn't reach.
"Houghton, that you?"
I nodded, adjusting my cap down lower over my eyes, one hand straying to the rifle I'd slung over my shoulder.
"What's..."
His mind unfurled in spirals of green and white and red. I needed him to tap his security badge against the black pad behind him, so he did. I needed him to step aside, so he did. He did everything I asked, even holding the door open for me as I stepped inside. I crossed the threshold into the warm heart of the camp. The heat from the vents sank through the layers of borrowed clothes, straight to my skin and bones. As I looked down the hall, toward the stairs leading up to the platform 2 stories overhead, I don't know when I had ever felt so powerful in my life. The door to my right opened, and a camp controller came out, holding a mug of coffee between his hands. The room behind him disappeared as the door slowly swung shut, but not before I saw the TV, the couches and chairs. His black button-down shirt wrinkled as he brought a hand up to yawn. The look he gave me was a friendly, "What can you do?" Half embarrassed, half unapologetic. Like the whole thing was one big joke. I smiled, letting him pass by to get to the door propped open a short ways down the hall. After a beat, I followed. The left half of the building's lower level was little more than an enormous monitoring station. Screens large and small lined the far wall, each showing a different angle of the camp. One was simply set to a satellite image of the weather. One showed a news channel on mute. There were 3 rows of computers in total, though only half of the seats seemed to be occupied. It looked as though they were starting to pack this room up as well, working from left to right, slowly removing the non-essential stations. This is why they needed the Reds, I thought. The draft was up for so many PSFs, and the ones that remained, along with the newer recruits, were tasked with moving the files and supplies in advance of the camp's closure.
Focus.
I stepped down to the 2nd row, sliding into the seat. The monitor flickered to life, waking up to reveal a basic desktop. Blood pounded in my ears, but my hands were surprisingly steady as I inserted the flash drive. The folder opened, and I transferred the program file over onto the desktop. I thought I'd misread it at first, my mind half consumed with anxiety, but Jude.exe transferred quickly and appeared on the screen's black background next to the trash icon, just below a black triangular outline labeled Security. When it finished, I erased the original file from the flash drive and dropped it to the floor, crushing the plastic shell under the heel of my left boot. The clock on the lower right-hand corner of the screen read 19:20. I opened the command prompt window, typed Start Jude.exe, and the icon disappeared from the desktop. Nothing else happened. Shit, I thought, glancing at the small clock again. Was that right? Why would... The blow cracked against the back of my skull so hard I was thrown halfway off the seat, caught at the last second by a hand that wrenched me back and slammed me against the table, hand at my throat, gun in my face.
Here.
The PSF's face split into 2. I blinked, trying to clear my vision as more shapes flooded in through the open door.
Here.
I was pulled off the desk and shoved onto the floor, the pistol inches from my forehead to make room for a camp controller to take my seat and begin typing. Someone had finally noticed something then. It was over. But I'd done what I needed to. I'd gotten this far. I'd done this, at least. The others in the room stood, alarmed, but backed off when Orion's familiar voice barked,
"Stay clear."
He typed something else, opened the command prompt window.
"What did you do?"
he snarled. I focused on his face, ignoring the warm trickle down the back of my neck. My line of sight solidified again, and I shrugged, a smirk working its way onto my lips. Orion pushed the other soldier away, back into the ring of PSFs and camp controllers who stood nearby with their weapons drawn. My teeth clacked as he threw me back up against the wall, demanding,
"What is your purpose here?"
I wiped the blood from the corner of my mouth and said nothing. There wasn't a damn thing he could do to me now that could make me feel afraid or small or helpless. The camp controller turned back to another woman sitting nearby.
"Key up the calm control."
"Group C is still in the mess hall," she said. "Should they be ordered back to their cabins first?"
"Key it up."
She turned back to her screen and typed furiously, ending with a stroke of her pinky against the return key.
"Wait."
One by one, the monitors on the wall winked out. Then each computer screen, the images blacking out with a sinister electronic hiss.
"Start the fail-safe protocol," he said.
"Sir?" she said, startled, but tried. She tried. "I'm locked out."
"Of what?"
"Everything."
"Me too."
"Same."
I knew it was pointless, even as I got my feet under me, but I didn't want to admit it. I wasn't done. I wasn't ready for it to be over. The guns around me were a dozen different ways to die. I was boxed in on all sides by black uniforms. My ears rang and the ground rolled beneath my feet, but I let the invisible hands in my mind go streaming out to the minds around me. I sent them sailing in every direction like arrows seeking targets. Orion pulled his arm back and punched me in the face. I couldn't get my hands up fast enough to block him, couldn't get them down fast enough to catch me. I slammed into the ground, my vision bursting with static as my skull cracked against the tile. He leaned over me, unclipping a small device from his belt, holding it next to my right ear. I spit in his face, and he only laughed, switching on the white noise. The world shattered around me. Hands seized my arms and hauled me up from the ground, dragging me through the tangle of legs and chairs. I couldn't see straight, couldn't clear my brain from the sounds polluting it. Every muscle in my body was seizing up, making me jerk, my feet thrash against the floor, and inside I was screaming. I was screaming, "I'm not done!" But I couldn't hear myself think. The white noise took me by the shoulders and shoved me down beneath the darkness, holding me there until I drowned. 26. The slap whipped across my face, ripping away the shroud of unconsciousness. My vision blurred as my eyes flew open, squinting against the light. My mind felt swollen and tender, as wrung out as the rest of my body. I was half conscious of the fact that my arms and legs were still spasming, the muscles twitching. The residual pain left me dumb and slow, and I couldn't remember why. How it had happened. The noise blistering my mind shut off abruptly. Slowly, slowly, the room solidified around me. Tile floor, four dark walls, one lamp. Two figures in black, moving in and out of the shadows, speaking in low tones. I heard a faint metallic clicking as one of them came closer. I smelled the mint as he smacked his gum.
"Little bitch."
And just like that, memory slammed into me. Tower. Out. Run. I twisted, trying to pull out of the chair they'd put me in, but my hands and ankles were zip-tied to the metal frame. The jolt of fear-induced adrenaline cleared my mind just in time for Orion to backhand me.
"Now that we have your attention,"
he snarled, rising to his feet. Cold air bit into my shin, and I looked down to find that he'd rolled both of my pant legs up to the knee. They'd stripped the PSF uniform jacket off me, taking the knife, the weapons, anything I could have used to fight back. The boots, too, though I didn't understand why. Not until Orion motioned for the baton the PSF behind him carried. The other man took that as his signal to hold up the handheld white noise machine. I reared like a wild horse, trying to escape it, the way it blanked out my mind.
What could I do? What?
Who sent you? Orion asked. What was your purpose here?
To tell you?
The words didn't sound nearly as furious coming out of my mouth as they did in my head. The camp controller leaned forward, eyes narrowing into slits.
To go fuck yourself.
The white noise came on, louder, higher, a bullet that slammed through my temples. I couldn't keep the cry in. Sweat streamed down my back, my chest. It became a pattern. On, agony, off, pain. On, agony, off, pain. I couldn't catch my breath. I had to fight to keep the sweet nothing of unconsciousness away. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't leave this moment. They would kill me. I wouldn't be able to.
Who sent you?
Fuck you!
I shouted right back in his face. I braced myself as he swung his arm back, but it did nothing. Nothing to prepare me for the explosion of white-hot agony that rocketed through me as his baton struck my exposed shin. I screamed, jerking against the restraints. I heard the crack, felt it inside of my head like it was my skull splitting apart. The PSF behind the camp controller only watched impassively as Orion struck the broken bone again, smiling as I vomited onto the floor. He swung again, stopping just short of my leg, a mocking smile on his face. He gave a silent wave of his hand toward the PSF, who reached for the white noise device again.
"Not the Children's League,"
Orion said over the hurricane of sound shredding my overloaded nerves.
"It couldn't be them. So who?"
I heard the echo of it even when it was switched off, white spots sparking behind my eyelids.
"Answer me, 3285.
He leaned over my face, thrusting the mangled flash drive in front of it.
"What was on this? Tell me, and I promise that you'll live."
"I want to live."
Orion gripped my chin in his hand.
3285. You should know I have no qualms about putting your kind down.
My kind. Orange. I sucked in a sharp breath, licking the blood that had run from my nose over my busted lip. Orange.
He turned back toward the PSF, motioning him forward. My leg was demanding my attention, burning up my concentration. But my eyes slid over to the younger man, and I reached. Orion held up the white noise device in one hand, his service pistol in the other.
"Which would you prefer?"
"I have to walk out of here."
The gun came up in his hand, sliding up my throat, under my chin. The white noise device rubbed along the edge of my ear.
"It would give me no greater pleasure than to see your brain scrambled and leaking from your ears, splattered against this floor. Tell me why you're here, 3285, and I'll stop this. It'll all be over."
"I want to live."
The building shook, throwing him back a step and rattling both the nearby table and the simple light fixture hanging over us. The pop and snarl of distant gunfire. A strange, sweet symphony of hope. Footsteps pounded down the hall, heading out toward the exit. Orion shoved himself away from me and went to the one-way window lining the wall, cupping his hands against it to try to see through it. He knocked against the mirrored surface, waiting. My line of sight was shrinking again, heading into black. The door in the corner, the one we'd come in through, had no handle. It could only be opened from the outside. I closed my eyes, tightening my fists against a second wave of nausea. I want to live. I want to live. I have to live. Ruby, I croaked out. Orion turned slowly.
What was that, 3285? You ready to talk now?
My name, I said between clenched teeth, is Ruby. I overturned my chair, knocking myself over onto the ground, and an aftershock of pain lanced up my leg. I played the scene out in my mind and heard the reality on a half-second delay. The PSF in the corner of the room lifted his gun and fired three times, missing Orion on the first shot and shattering a section of the glass behind him, but hitting his mark on the second and third attempt. Chest, head. Orion got one shot off, hitting the PSF's throat before slumping down against the wall beneath the one-way window. I must have passed out for a few seconds, maybe minutes. The control tower was eerily silent, and the only sound I heard as I surfaced back to reality was my own heart's slow, steady beat. Move, I ordered myself. Move, Ruby, move. My progress across the floor to Orion's body was slow and agonizing. I needed the knife on his belt to cut the ties on my feet and hands, but it meant dragging the chair through the puddle of congealing blood beneath him. I sawed frantically, nicking my palms as I worked the knife blindly behind me. I sucked in a harsh breath and looked down. The strange, tented skin on my shin made me gag, the sight reminding my body all over again that it was in pain. I hopped and hobbled over to the door, but I'd been right. There was no handle, and the hinges were on the other side. I picked up Orion's pistol and positioned myself against the opposite wall, using it as a brace for the gun's recoil. The reverberations raced up my arms and shoulders as the glass shards fell in waves. I switched the safety back on and went to work knocking the remaining pieces out of the window frame. Bracing my hands on the ledge, I dragged myself up and over it. The jagged teeth caught and tore at my arms and legs as I collapsed into the hallway. The gun flew out of my hands. I reached for it through the halo of glass around me. My fingers closed around the grip, just as the squeak of rubber against the tile reached my ears. I rolled onto my back, lifting my torso up just enough to aim at the dark figure running toward me. I fumbled with the safety, switching it off. The barrage of gunfire outside heated my blood, focusing me in the moment. I saw the black uniform, and my finger curled around the trigger. I was getting out of here. I was getting out. Don't shoot! The power snapped off, throwing the building into darkness, but I'd seen his face as he pulled up his helmet. I thought at first that I was seeing a ghost, and somehow the reality was almost more impossible. Liam. Stop doing that! I cried, dropping my gun in terror. I almost killed you! His face was so thin, practically worn down to the bone. He rushed toward me, dropping to his knees and sliding the last bit of distance between us. His hands were everywhere at once, and he was kissing me, lips, cheeks, forehead, wherever he could reach, and I was breathing him in, clinging to his sopping wet shirt, unable to process the simple fact that he was here, that he was okay. He shifted, jarring my leg, and I couldn't keep the scream from escaping my throat. Shit! Shit, I'm sorry, Jesus! Liam fumbled for the radio, clipped to his jacket. I found her! Dad, I need your help! It almost happened too quickly. Footsteps pounded against the ground behind me, and when Liam looked up, it was as if his helpless anger solidified, grew teeth. He reached for the gun in the holster strapped to his leg, and a shudder ripped through me. I recognized the darkness in his expression I'd seen all too many times in his brother. My hand flew out, slamming down on his, keeping his weapon in place. Not Liam. Not now. Not ever. He wasn't a killer. Losing himself in a single moment would fracture him at his core. It would be a bone that healed crookedly inside him until it changed his shape. I saw the moment he came back to himself, the way his nostrils flared and his eyes cleared. When he looked up at the PSF running toward us again, this time he threw a hand out, sending the soldier crashing back into the nearest wall, knocking him out cold. He released a shuddering breath as he looked down at me again. Gently, with a level of care that seemed at odds with his actions only a second ago, he inspected the cuts on my arms and swore. I was trembling, but he must have mistaken the pain for cold because he ripped his jacket off and drew it around me, zipping it up my throat to trap the warmth inside. I bit back the sob welling in my chest.
"Why did it have to be you?"
he demanded.
"Why did it have to be you?"
"Sorry," I whispered. "For Cole. For making him come here. For everything. In case the darkness came back and I couldn't say it then. Sorry. Love you. Love you so much." Liam kissed me again.
"Can we get the hell out of here now?"
Another figure in black appeared at the head of the stairs, his shoulders heaving as he caught his breath. I scrambled for my gun, but Liam gripped my hand.
"Over here!"
I saw a flash of black skin, a handsome, grizzled face as he rushed toward us.
"Is she all right?"
"Not really," Liam said, leaning back so his stepfather could see my leg. To me, he insisted,
"But you're going to be fine, you hear me?"
"Ouch, darling,"
Harry said, crouching down to examine it.
"We're going to get you out of here, all right?"
I have to walk out of here,
I told him, mind fogging over with the pain.
"I have to walk out of here. My own feet."
He exchanged a tense look with Liam.
"We need something to brace it with," Liam started, looking around.
"There's no time for that," Harry said. "They'll have medics at the meet point."
"I have to walk out."
I didn't care how crazy it made me sound. They needed to understand. Cole would understand. Would have understood. Cole was past tense now. I squeezed my eyes shut. When I opened them again, Harry reached over to a radio clipped onto his left shoulder.
"This is Stuart. We have her. Proceeding to exit. ETA 3 minutes.
There was a flurry of static responses.
"Okay, darling, I'm gonna get you up,"
Liam said, rising to his feet.
"Put your arms around my shoulders. That's right. Just like that."
True to their word, once they had me up, they adjusted me so I could stand on my good leg. I don't remember the hallway as it passed us, only how it felt each time my right leg swung forward. The frigid air on my skin as we stepped out into the night. The first touch of rain. I smelled smoke. The air hung heavy with it. Up ahead, there was a river of green and blue moving out of the camp's front gate. The kids walked quickly, waved on by figures in black, their white bands stark against their sleeves. I was proud of how calm they were, the way they listened to the instructions they were given, even half terrified or in shock. Thurmond, at least, had trained them to do that much.
"Reds,"
I tried to say. I saw the warm glow of a fire at the far end of the camp, where the factory was burning.
"They're secured,"
Harry said, giving the hand I'd hooked around his neck a gentle squeeze.
"Put up one hell of a fight."
"Hurt?"
"Everyone's okay,"
he promised. He let out a sharp whistle, and the nearest figure in black turned around expectantly and ran toward us. She moved with a kind of animal grace, arms pumping at her side, boots spraying mud everywhere as she trampled through the puddles and thick black mud. I couldn't see her face through the curtain of rain, but I knew. Vida. She would have crashed into us if Harry hadn't put out a strong hand to catch her.
Careful,
Liam warned, drawing me closer to his side as Harry pulled back and untangled his grip. Vida filled in the spot he'd vacated, wrapping both arms around me.
Holy shit,
she said.
I'm going to kill you. I'm actually going to wring your little neck. I'm going to...
I'm going to sweep through the mess one last time to check for stragglers,
Harry said.
Mac, John, and I will bring up the rear.
See you at the meet point, Liam said.
Ruby, let me carry you, please.
I have to walk.
My throat ached, the words coming out in a croak.
Can you help me?
He had already started to adjust his grip when Vida stopped him by taking the other half of my weight.
Whatever you want, as long as it means getting you out of this goddamn nightmare factory. I mean, holy shit, boo!
Our progress was slow and awkward through the mud, but we staggered forward, drifting into the rush of kids moving out, heading toward the gate that was blown wide open. It rained the day they brought us to Thurmond, and it rained the day I walked out. I knew I was in trouble when I couldn't shake the cold, couldn't stop trembling. As we walked through the woods, following the kids ahead of us, the black uniforms with white bands at the front, my shivering made my muscles lock and limbs seize. Vida glanced over at Liam, and our pace quickened.
Hurts,
I whispered.
Do you want to stop? Rest? Vida asked. Is it your leg?
I shook my head.
Everything.
To fill the silence, or to distract me, Liam tried to explain what had happened.
Mom gave me the number to contact Harry, to tell him about Cole. She told me how to find him. They waited for me, and by then I knew I should have gone straight back, that I wanted to. But by the time we made it to the ranch, you were long gone. Chubbs was beside himself, so was Zoo, all of them. Nico held it together for them until we got back.
Fucking Clancy, Vida said. Fucking crazy-ass Grays. They did this broadcast, him and his mom.
I saw, I said, not willing or particularly able to go into detail at that moment.
How did you... Never mind, it doesn't matter,
Liam said.
You tell me later, when this is over and done with.
Cole,
I started to say, my grip on him tightening. His face twisted with fresh grief.
Later, okay? It's not too much farther. We had to set the meet point nearby. Too many kids to drive out. I wish you could have seen it. Amplify pushed the information we gave them out everywhere. TV, the internet, traffic signs. They bombarded the world with the truth.
Let's see if it actually worked, Vida muttered. If there aren't any parents waiting...
They'll be waiting,
Liam insisted. No matter how many steps I took, it still felt like we were falling farther and farther away from the lights filtering through the trees. I knew he was right, though, when the first helicopter appeared over us, casting a light down and kicking up the wind and rain. It was blinding. I couldn't tell if it belonged to the military or to the news. There had been a din of noise, this faint, low buzz of energy and sound I'd barely been able to detect under the shrill ringing in my ears. Now it was like I could hear the pulse of the world around me, throbbing underfoot. Up ahead, there were more lights, all pointed toward us. The assault team, kids and adults alike, brought the huge group up short, just past the line of trees. There were buildings nearby, most likely the abandoned downtown area of Thurmond, West Virginia. Liam and Vida navigated us up through the sea of stalled bodies, shouldering our way closer to the front. 3,000 children spread out through the trees like an avalanche, stopping up every gap between them. I knew when we were close, because someone got on a bullhorn and barked out,
"Remain where you are. Any advancement will be seen as a sign of hostile aggression."
But if the armed forces saw us, So did the families gathered behind them. We were moving forward again, slowly now, but at a steady pace. Finally, through the blinding field ahead of us, shapes began to form. Two large white tents had been set up by someone.